I think today's conference is really important. So much of the time, it seems like we listen to ourselves in the Beltway talk about preferences in trade and development, and it's finally nice to get some voices from Africa to tell us how our policies are being impacted in sub-Saharan Africa. As mentioned, I work for Congressman Jim McDermott. McDermott was one of the key architects of AGOA. He worked really beginning in 1994 through 2000 trying to get a preference regime established in sub-Saharan Africa. As many of you know, AGOA has been amended 3 times since it was signed into law in 2000. So there's been a real long-term effort to try and get our trade policy right with respect to Africa. As I listened to the first and the second panels, and reading the reports that have been put forward, it's become really clear that globalization isn't just changing things here in the United States and causing discomfort here. Many of the same challenges it imposes here, it's imposing on developing countries, and developing countries that don't have the capacity to really respond in the way that we do. The minimum wage issue was talked about from somebody earlier, and they were mentioning how it's a political decision instead of a recognition of what it means or what it takes to have a decent standard of living on a minimum wage. Well, it's true in probably Lesotho, but it's also true in the United States. Look how long it took us to pass minimum wage reform last year. I think it was a decade or so. I think what I'm going to do is first let's zoom back out and talk about why. I want to talk about why we have preference regimes, what the aim of them is, and then we'll kind of zoom back in on preference reform and one piece of legislation that's been put forward. So first, the reason we do preferences, at least the reason many progressives support preferences, is it's a means by which we believe we can help reduce poverty. 1 in 5 of the Earth's population, 1 billion of us, live in extreme poverty, and extreme poverty is defined as less than a dollar a day. And when you compare that to how well we're doing, the United States and the other developed countries, it's really quite scandalous. But even when you compare us to middle-income countries and compare middle-income countries to poor countries, we'll see that middle-income countries have done pretty okay over the last few decades. They've experienced economic growth between 2.5 to 4.5% since the 1970s. So for middle-income countries and for the rich countries, time's really been on our side because the more time goes by, the better we are. But the reverse is really true for poor countries. In the 1970s, their economies were growing at about 0.5%. And over the ensuing couple of decades, their economies actually declined 0.5%. So for the least developed countries and the billion people that live within them, time has been against them. Every day, they lose more and more hope. And what does that mean for people? I mean, the majority of those living in extreme poverty live in sub-Saharan Africa. And in Africa, you know, a lot of children, 1 in 6 children, die before reaching 5. And in Africa, hunger is a key factor in more deaths than the infectious diseases combined. So we have a real moral, I believe, reason to try and improve our development policy, and we can do that in part through trade. But there's also some security and commercial interests. I think the World Bank did a study several years ago showing that countries with economies that are not diversified, that are relying on one commodity for export, are 25 times more likely to experience civil strife and civil conflict. And that, of course, has real negative outcomes on their economy, not just while they're in strife, but for years to come. So I backed up and said, why do progressives support preferences? Well, first, let's look at our trade policy more generally. The average duty tariff assessed on products that are coming from rich countries, 1%. But the average tariff assessed on products that come from poor countries is 3%. In fact, the HELP Commission recently came out with a report. The HELP Commission is a bipartisan commission established by Congress and the President. They came out with a report, preliminary report recently, and they showed that the tariffs collected from the LDC countries exceeded the amounts of money they received from the Millennium Challenge Corporation. And, you know, you look at this data, and it really should be no surprise that the level of trade from the LDCs has really diminished over time. It was about 4% 5 decades ago, and it's now, you know, not even 1%. So, in general, how do we go about trade liberalization? 3 ways: multilateral through the WTO, And as many of you know, the WTO has changed over time. It was first the GATT in 1947. But in 47, it was mostly the developed countries that were creating this new regime to start managing trade flows. Today, it's much more the developed countries. Developing countries are part of the WTO, and I think you see that playing out within the Doha round for sure, but it even started in the Uruguay round. The developing countries have quite a bit of power within the World Trade Organization and the multilateral trading process, in part because, well, mostly because it's a body that governs by unanimous consent. And that's really important. The problem is that rich countries want to liberalize trade much faster than poor countries generally. And so as the multilateral process slows down, you see that the United States and others starts pursuing bilateral agreements, and you've seen a real proliferation of those. And that presents problems for developing countries because they have small markets. Rich countries don't want a free trade agreement, a bilateral trade agreement with an LDC. There's not much in it. So the proliferation of bilateral trade agreements, I think, is problematic from a perspective of the least developed countries. The third way we liberalize trade is through preference programs. We provide, and developed countries provide, unilateral market access to products that come from developing countries. We do it in a number of ways. It started with GSP, Generalized System of Preferences. We did some programs for Central America, for Latin America, and more recently, in 2000, we did the African Growth and Opportunity Act. The preference regimes really started in the 1960s, in part because of John Kennedy. President Kennedy said, I love quotes, he said, "American apathy would be, towards poor countries, would be disastrous to our national security, harmful to our comparative prosperity, and offensive to our conscience." And what ultimately came out of the Kennedy round that I think was really pivotal is it amended the GATT to say that we should give asymmetrical market access to poor countries. And we followed up with that by enacting the Generalized System of Preferences. Looking at all the preferences combined, you'll see that they don't really make that much of a difference in terms of our imports at the moment. Of the nearly $2 trillion in imports, only about 5% of the products coming in come in under the preference regimes. And the middle-income countries, the primary beneficiaries, the middle-income countries that are producing industrial goods, whether it's auto parts or airplane parts, are primarily benefiting from the preference regimes. Apparel and agriculture, which is tends to be sectors that LDC countries have a comparative advantage in, whether it's because of low wages or because so many people are involved in agriculture, they're not benefiting so much from the preference regimes because the preference regimes exclude what we call sensitive agriculture products. And the apparel benefits that we provide are the rules of origin or the rules by which the products can come in are often very complicated and serve as a barrier to imports. One of the things we've discovered, when we did AGOA in 2000, there was a lot of lofty Obama-like rhetoric, if you will, about what AGOA is going to achieve. And this all comes from politicians who naturally want to see their bill passed. What we've seen since then is really, it's been eye-opening. The good thing is Congress has paid a lot of attention to AGOA. It has paid less attention to the other regimes, and although we see the same trends in those regimes too. In fact, we have the GAO working for us on a number of reports, and the last time there was a systematic review of GSP was 1980, 25 years ago. But nonetheless, AGOA, we spent a lot of time trying to understand the impact of AGOA, and we've learned a lot of things, that capacity constraints have really limited the scope of AGOA's impact. You know, in order for a preference program or any trade policy to really help development, or any help any country, that country has to be producing a surplus. It's got to be producing more than it can consume, and have the ability to export it and discover foreign markets. And when you think about poor countries, landlocked countries, countries where corruption is prevalent and democracy hasn't taken the kind of foothold that we would like to see, you can understand why preference regimes aren't going to work. They may work for Lesotho because they may be landlocked, but they're landlocked in a country that's relatively developed compared to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. The preferences aren't going to work in a country like Chad. They may work in Ghana. You have to have access to ports. So it's really capacity constraints. And what we've discovered is that, and the administration has discovered this too, is that preferences aren't going to do what we want on their own. There was this debate about it's countries want trade, not aid. Museveni is fond of saying that. But in fact, the lesson of AGOA and the lesson of all the preferences is that you need trade capacity building linked with the preferences. And although we're spending more and more money on trade capacity building, the GAO has said that it's uncoordinated, the goals are ambiguous, there are no measurements of success. So real reform needs to be done in trade capacity and development assistance generally, and the HELP Commission report shows that. But in addition to executing trade capacity building more effectively, you have to provide meaningful benefits. And for LDC countries, that includes providing duty-free access on all their products, agriculture and apparel included. So what does Congressman McDermott's bill do? It's doing a few things, I think. At first, we're reducing trade barriers in terms of tariffs. And we have new eligibility criteria. We've all seen, and I think we'll see a GAO report come out shortly, that shows that the eligibility criteria that we put in these preference regimes, it's always progress towards, you know, promotion of labor rights or progress towards enforcement of intellectual property. There are really no clear benchmarks, and the administration doesn't systematically look at countries in a consistent way, and the Congress has done very little oversight on this. So what we do is, in this legislation, we beef up the eligibility criteria. There's no more progress towards. There's going to be clear, bright-line tests about whether a country will qualify for the duty-free access. And within this bill now, it's core labor rights need to be not only in law, but enforced. And importantly, I believe, we couple the duty-free access with trade capacity building in a smarter way than we're doing now. So first, in terms of what we're doing on tariffs, we're eliminating duties and quotas on every single product, period. So if Mali wants to export some sugar, some cotton, they're going to export it without tariff. That's important because there's been proposals over time that we should do something like this for least developed countries. But there's always this talk about, well, let's exclude sensitive goods. Well, those sensitive goods happen to be the goods that are most important to poor countries. This is technical. We have these what we call rules of origin and preference programs and all trade agreements, really. We'll say, well, we're getting rid of tariffs on your products, but then we have these rules that say whether a product sufficiently comes from your country, whether it's your product or not. In the case of CAFTA and Central American preferences, for instance, we say that the apparel you produce can come in tariff-free as long as you made the fabric or you bought the fabric from the United States. That doesn't take into account whether U.S. fabric is competitively priced and commercially available. So what we say in this bill is that there's going to be a development-friendly rule of origin so that you can source your inputs from the most competitive source. But the rule of origin does provide an incentive to ensure that there's significant production going on within the country and job creation. And then this is important. All of our preference regimes are temporary. Sometimes we extend them for 5 years, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it expires and we put them back in retroactively. And you can imagine how difficult it is if you're a business trying to make commercial decisions about whether to source in a country. But importantly, it's also important for the World Bank if they want to make loans to a country to get involved in a sector that's important to them and a sector that has duty-free access. And governments, if you've got a temporary preference regime, how does the government decide they're going to spend taxpayer dollars on taking advantage of that regime if the regime isn't permanent? So that's important. The other thing we do is we try to link up the trade capacity building with the preferences. And what we would do in this legislation is we say we create an independent office at AID with a director. And that director has got a budget, $5 billion. And the director would be in charge of all trade capacity building that's going on in least developed countries. Right now, about 80% of the trade capacity building money is being spent by AID. but in a number of ways that are completely uncoordinated. The rest of, by the way, the rest of the trade capacity building that's going to LDCs is spent by different agencies that aren't even talking to USAID. So we would create this independent office with the director, and the director would have full control over the money that's at AID that's going to trade capacity building in least developed countries. The money, the trade capacity building should be targeted, we instructed to be targeted towards reducing constraints to export-led economic growth that can really reduce poverty. We have some other instructions in there regarding focusing on small businesses and agriculture in particular. We'd also say that of the money that's ultimately appropriated for this purpose, that not less than 20% should go towards investments for the workforce. One thing that we've done in these preference regimes is we've said, in order to qualify, you've got to meet these certain standards. You've got to make progress on these standards. And when you tell that to a poor country, they say, how? We don't have the money. And so I think it's critically important that if we're going to demand higher labor standards or higher standards generally, we've got to help countries. We've got to go into countries and help them comply with the eligibility criteria. And so we separate some money out just for that. And then what we do is to try and force Congress, if you will, force the executive and encourage the Congress to really hold the administration accountable on how this money is being spent. The legislation requires what we call an annual report card on competitiveness. And that report card would detail what money has been spent in each country and on what projects and what kind of outcomes have been achieved. The annual report card would also detail a lot of other things, particularly around eligibility criteria. And as a side note, just think of some of the capacity constraints that could exist, especially in Africa. When you think of Africa, you know that two-thirds of the country is involved in agriculture. And 80% of what's going on in agriculture is done by women. Women are really, really important in development. But in Africa, women may be responsible for 80% of the food production, but they control 1% of the land. So there are a number of things we can do to help improve this. We can help with land rights. We can help with access to capital. Imagine if you're a woman and you do have some land. Actually, take it back. Imagine if you're a woman and you can control land, but you don't own it. How do you get credit? What collateral do you have? You may control the land, but if you don't own it, you can't get access to credit, to capital, to seeds, to whatever it takes to grow your products. And one of the really interesting things I think we do in here is we try to learn from the Cambodian model, and that is the model where if you provide market access on a product that a country wants, but you tell them, we're going to give market access little by little as you make progress on labor standards, we saw that Cambodia responded. Maybe not in ways fully like we would hope, but they definitely responded, and it definitely improved the labor conditions in Cambodia and improved development, in fact. So what we do in this legislation is say that the market access that the non-African LDCs who don't currently have any market access because they don't currently benefit from AGOA, their market access is going to be tied to progress on labor rights. So although they have to enforce core labor rights in order to qualify, if they do better than that, then they'll have more access to the American market. And we can talk more about that when Carol goes through this. So where do we stand? There's growing support for this bill and this concept. I think it's important to recognize that in 2000, in the Millennium Development Goals, we committed to providing duty-free access to products that come from poor countries. The Livingstone Declaration was a declaration signed in Zambia by the Africans prior to the Hong Kong ministerial of the WTO saying that they wanted duty-free, quota-free access on all products. That ultimately became a document at the WTO, so the United States and other countries agreed to provide duty-free access to products that come from LDCs. The question is, actually the debate is whether we wait for Doha to do it or do we do something before Doha, and I think most people believe that Doha is certainly dead for a while. I mentioned that the Help Commission came out with a report. They're encouraging us to do something similar, as is the Center for American Progress, and key NGOs have endorsed this legislation, and the private sector has been supportive too. And I thought, interestingly, the Secretary General of the UN last week, maybe earlier this week, announced this is the year of the bottom billion. And he points to the progress in the Millennium Development Goals and mentions that we've made some progress, but we have a lot more to do, and we really need to focus on helping poor countries, the LDCs, where the bottom billion live, better benefit from globalization. And we can do that in part through trade and in part through development policies. So I think I'll summarize just by saying, you know, progressives come at trade generally not as an end, but as a means. Trade is a means by which we can help improve the human condition through development in a number of other ways. For others, certainly, trade is philosophical. It's a freedom issue, and that's not the case for progressives. So that as we go forward today and we learn more, you know, it makes sense for us to understand what's going on with our trade policies. Is it helping people to the extent it should? How can we change the trade policies and change our development policies so that they're better coordinated and they are, in fact, lifting people up? So with that, I'll conclude and turn it over to Carol.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie. Oh, okay, everyone can hear me? Great. Jamie just gave a great overview of the bill, and what I'd like to just focus very specifically on the workers' rights provisions that he mentioned and that Jeff Vogt also mentioned this morning in his presentation. I think first I should take a step back and explain what Human Rights Watch's position is on the legislation. We are not a development organization. We're agnostic on trade, so we don't support or oppose the bill per se, but we are very supportive of the workers' rights provisions. We really think that they are a step forward for the treatment of labor rights in U.S. unilateral trade preference programs, and we think Jamie and Representative McDermott have really done a very good job in trying to, I think, create a new model for how workers' rights could be protected in the context of such preference programs. I think the best way to understand the difference between the labor rights provisions in this bill and in existing unilateral trade preference programs is to look at those programs. We discussed those a bit earlier. Jeff did in his presentation, and Jamie mentioned them again. We have GSP. We have the Caribbean Basin Trade Partnership Act, the Andean Trade Promotion and Drug Eradication Act, and, of course, AGOA. And I don't want to spend much time on this because it's already been mentioned, but there's general consensus that the labor rights provisions in those programs fall far short of what would be needed to really protect workers' rights on the ground. In GSP, GSP states that the president may not designate a country as a beneficiary if that country has not taken or is not taking steps to afford internationally recognized worker rights. The Caribbean and the Andean programs require the president to take into account the extent to which countries are providing internationally recognized worker rights. And as Jeff mentioned this morning, AGOA states that the president can only designate a country a beneficiary if it has established or is making continual progress towards establishing the protection of internationally recognized worker rights. And the problem here is obvious. With GSP and AGOA, beneficiary countries must simply show that they're trying, which is a very, very low threshold, as we've seen throughout the years in terms of its enforcement. Under CBTPA and ATPDA, the Caribbean and Andean programs, the criteria is really arguably even more ambiguous. What does it mean to consider the extent to which a country is protecting workers' rights? It's really not clear. And furthermore, as Jeff mentioned, but I do think it's worth reiterating, the definition of internationally recognized worker rights in all of these programs excludes the elimination of employment and workplace discrimination, which, of course, is one of the four core ILO labor standards as defined by the Declaration. So each of these acts, in addition, provides very, very little in terms of effective monitoring, in terms of the capacity building that Jamie was referring to, in terms of a clear, well-defined role for Congress to provide input on eligibility criteria, very little to aid in terms of aid to facilitate compliance. There really isn't much on any of these fronts. Of course, you do have the annual petition process for GSP and the Andean program, which allows for the submission of complaints claiming violation of eligibility criteria. But there's no requirement that there be a reasoned, thoughtful decision and from the U.S. government on these complaints. And in our experience, there seems to be no requirement for a decision at all. Human Rights Watch has 3 complaints pending against Ecuador under the Indian Trade Promotion Drug Eradication Act from 2003, 2004, and 2005. We have no decision and no response. Obviously, that's not an effective enforcement of the workers' rights criteria. Now, the New Partnership for Development Act, of course, isn't perfect. And as I, you know, heard June speak this morning, I was kind of reflecting on where it might fall short and how some of her, you know, very real concerns about, you know, companies coming in for a year or less and then leaving, and the failure of companies to really provide for skills transfer for the local workers, how that kind of those kinds of concerns could be addressed in legislation like this. And I really don't know. I don't think that has been part of the discussion on the Hill or elsewhere in terms of how workers on the ground can really benefit. Our focus has been much more a rights-based looking at, you know, the ILO conventions and then UN instruments. But I think it's something that I think we all should think about. I don't have the answer. You know, I think it was a very good point that June made, and I think we should consider how we can address that. But that aside, I think that the Act does have some very good provisions, and I'd just like to go into them briefly and then kind of at the end provide some thoughts. As Jamie mentioned, for the first time, this Act would require the president to terminate a country's eligibility if it had not adopted and maintained in its laws and regulations the core labor rights as defined by the International Labor Organization, and would also require termination of eligibility if a country has failed to effectively enforce through a sustained or recurring course of action or inaction in a manner affecting trade or investment, that's the language, between the United States and the beneficiary, all of the laws related to those core rights as well as acceptable conditions of work, which are those laws related to minimum wage, hours of work, occupational safety, and health. And, I mean, this is a big deal. You know, the requirement is absolute. There's no progressive implementation. And it's similar to the workers' rights language in the free trade agreements that have been modeled on the trade policy template from this past May, the agreements with Panama, Peru, Colombia, and Korea. And arguably, it's even stronger. I don't want to go into how it might be stronger, but there's some discussion of that. And I think, you know, it's important because I think this signals that template should not simply be kind of a baseline or a minimum for free trade agreements, but also should be a minimum when we're thinking about how workers' rights are treated in U.S. trade policy generally. Obviously, this new requirement should make it much harder for a beneficiary to retain eligibility by simply taking a few superficial steps towards improving workers' rights, which is something that Jeff mentioned in his presentation. It's much easier to show that a country has not succeeded in protecting workers' rights than to show that a country isn't trying, obviously. So hopefully, you know, given the right administration and the political will, you know, these would be easier to enforce and to, you know, resulting in a benefit for workers on the ground. In addition, and Jamie mentioned this as well, building on the example of the U.S.-Cambodia textile agreement, the Act also provides an additional carrot for countries that can go one better than this basic workers' rights requirement and can show that not only are they protecting the core rights as defined by the ILO in trade-related sectors, but are actually protecting them throughout the economy in sectors not related to trade, such as, you know, domestic workers, possibly service sectors, this kind of thing. And the bill calls this a competitiveness incentive. And as Jamie alluded to, it's structured a bit strangely in the first 5 years of the legislation. It's really only relevant to Bangladesh and Cambodia. It would provide an increase in the quantitative limitation on their duty-free treatment for apparel. But from 2014 to 2018, this would be extremely relevant to all of the countries benefiting from this Act in that the $250 million in assistance provided for in the bill for capacity building for small and medium enterprises, agriculture, financial institutions, investment promotion, et cetera, all of that aid would be prioritized according to who was meeting that competitiveness incentive. So the countries that met that threshold would get a bigger chunk of that capacity building pie, which is important. Now, obviously, you know, we've been discussing, you know, all day that none of this is particularly useful if it's not enforced. So I want to discuss a little bit some of the enforcement-related provisions in the legislation. On this front, the legislation really departs, you know, again from the previous unilateral trade preference programs by providing mechanisms and programs to try to ensure that the labor rights criteria are applied. I'll go into each one briefly, but just, you know, Jamie has mentioned some of them. The creation of an office in USAID to oversee the act's implementation, workers' rights monitoring, a beefed up third-party petition process, this mandatory annual report card, which Jamie mentioned, an annual eligibility review that considers not only the report card, but congressional input on the report card, and engagement with countries found to have violated the labor rights criteria, as well as, finally, capacity building, the capacity building component, which Jamie also mentioned. This Office of Trade and Competitiveness for LDCs, which would be created in the U.S. in USAID, under the Act would be composed of jurists and an inspectorate staff with expertise in assessing compliance with the eligibility criteria, presumably also, you know, the workers' rights eligibility criteria. The Act provides for monitoring. The office would be charged with, among other things, assessing and reporting on compliance with the workers' rights eligibility criteria in conjunction with the Secretaries of Labor and State, and importantly, and this goes back to some of the comments June made this morning, in conjunction with civil society partners on the ground in the LDCs. And I think that's very important, that there would need to be dialogue, you know, between this office and with the partners on the ground to get their input on whether or not the countries are meeting the eligibility criteria. To facilitate monitoring, this act, also kind of taking a page out of the U.S.-Cambodia textile agreement, would require countries to provide reasonable access for officials to investigate and monitor compliance. As many of you probably recall, under the U.S.-Cambodia textile agreement, the government of Cambodia eventually wound up conditioning export licenses on factories granting access to ILO monitors, and I think this is modeled on that, and it proved to be very successful in the context of Cambodia. As I mentioned, there's a petition process. Unlike under the existing unilateral trade preference programs that Jeff referred to this morning, where it's an annual petition process, this would provide for submission of complaints at any time throughout the year, which is important, as Jeff noted, because sometimes you have a violation occurring many, many months before the petition process begins. In addition, the Act provides... Okay, sure. Just very quickly then, the Act does provide for the possibility of in-country monitoring in response to these petitions, you know, public hearings. It doesn't require it, but it provides for this possibility very much like the NAFTA Labor Side Agreement does for its complaint process. Mentioned the annual report card on competitiveness, which will include an assessment of whether or not the workers' rights eligibility criteria are being met, including a synthesis of any monitoring visits, public petitions, and the like. If noncompliance is found, and I think this is important, I just want to go into it really, really briefly. If noncompliance is found either based on petitions or based on the annual report card, the Director of Competitiveness must notify Congress and enter into consultations with the country in question to develop a plan in coordination with groups on the ground, again going back to June's comments, to try to bring that country into compliance. And it's only if that process doesn't work that the eligibility, that the benefits are terminated. And very quickly, the last and important point I think to mention is this workforce competitiveness program, which provides for a variety of different kinds of capacity building. I think the important ones to highlight are targeted technical and capacity building assistance for groups on the ground working on workers' rights issues, like trade unions, like NGOs, and developing these projects in conjunction with those organizations on the ground. Obviously, the idea of capacity building is not new. We see it in free trade agreements all the time, but I think what is really new is this real emphasis on coordination with the groups on the ground to try to make the capacity building as effective as possible. I think I'll stop there. I mean, obviously, the big question is going to work? You know, is it going to be enforced? It still does largely depend on the political will of whoever we have administering it. But I think regardless, it is a step forward.
I'm sure that both presentations have generated a number of questions. So let's take about 10 minutes, if that's okay, for question and answer, and then we'll go into the next panel. Mark.
Do either of you think that would any countries qualify today, what you know now, exist in those countries, under the provisions in the bill, would any countries qualify for benefits under the bill?
I think first we'll need to investigate. Most of the countries have adopted in their laws the core ILO standards. The question is, are they enforcing them? And most of them are enforcing 2 out of the 5 or 4 out of the 5 or 1 out of the 5, and according to the State Department. We need to know, the State Department, well, the director would need to go in and assert that whether or not they are, in fact, enforcing those standards, and then they would receive eligibility. So the answer is, no. I don't know. But what the State Department's saying so far is that most of them wouldn't currently, but a lot of them are very, very close. It's also important to remember, this doesn't replace anything. AGOA is in place, but it expires in 2015. So this is going to sit on top of this. And it's going to be a real incentive for countries to improve.
No.
Cheryl,
do you want to give your take on that question?
I mean, first, with the caveat that I'm not an expert on Africa and have done very little work there, the knowledge that I do have, I would say probably not.
Lots of Steve, do you want to
Thank you very much for the presentation. I have questions, but I would like to start with some conceptual variations. I have a different conceptual interpretation of a couple of things that you have presented. It doesn't mean that my conceptual presentation is any better, but just for this purpose of variety and to, you know, give an alternative understanding, if you allow me, I want to just make 2 comments, one for each one of you. First of all, on the issue of WTO, I think you are not right to say that WTO is a democratic organization and that it is controlled by developing countries. No, it's not right. WTO is controlled by a group called the Quads, and the Quads has got the US, Canada, EU, Australia, and Brazil. That's why you have the green room, and that's why you keep having mini ministerials. So although in paper WTO's constitution stipulates that it could be one of the most democratic institutions, it is not, and we all know. I was in Hong Kong, I was in Cancun. It is controlled by the powerful, rich few countries, and the Quad are in charge of WTO. The second conceptual mistake, in my opinion, in your analysis, is when you say that the developing countries do not want proliferation of agreements. That's not true. The reason why we have there's a problem with the proliferation of agreement is that they are asymmetrical. And in the past, EU and the US have not fulfilled the obligations of the agreements. You know, we have talked about subsidies. We've agreed that they'll be cut, and the EU and the US have refused to do that. So basically, the EU and the US are involved in illegal trade practices, which are distorting. That's a problem. So it's not because people don't want to go into agreements. They want. Everyone wants trade to be free. But we don't want trade to be free for just a particular group of people. We want trade to be free for everybody. The last conceptual note on your side was, I don't think that GSP is another form of trade agreement. GSP, in my opinion, is an affirmative action. And an affirmative action is normally put in place where there's been injustice. For example, we say, look, in Kenya, we are now saying you must have X percentage of women in particular institutions. Why? Because men have been bullies and have thrown women out of their rightful spaces. So affirmative action is about giving people their rightful spaces, and that's the notion behind, you know, trade preferences and so on. So that, again, conceptually is important. I'm not going to content yet. And then to my sister, I think there are two, again, conceptual difficulties that I had. One, you know, I don't know if Human Rights Watch has taken a good look into issues of trade and human rights so that to take a position that, to make a statement that you don't take a position when it comes to issues of this nature, because I think if you go back to what my friend here said, that trade is a means to development. And if trade is a means to development, therefore, as a human rights organization, we would be interested at looking at how do the trade conditionalities make it difficult for the state, for example, to fulfill its obligations. The state has the obligation to fulfill rights, to protect and to promote, you know, and ensure fulfillment of human rights. So we would like to assess to what extent do the trade agreements either promote or act deleteriously to already realized rights or undermine the role of the state. And if you look at some of the provisions in the proposed proposed act are so clear. By telling states to reduce their roles in the market, for example, and naming that they cannot undertake things like subsidies, how do you get education? Right to education, how do you have it realized? It is plainly clear. How do you have right to housing? It's plainly clear. So I think trade is plainly a human rights issue, and therefore it would be conceptually, in my opinion, inaccurate for a human rights organization to say that it is out of its purview. Those are the preliminary, just conceptual issue that I had to raise, and I'm saying that I'm not raising substantive issues yet. Thank you.
Since these are in the nature of comments, do you mind if I take a couple of comments and then you both can respond to each of those points, please?
Three related questions. Number one, if few or none of the intended beneficiary countries would qualify, doesn't this make the capacity building component of the legislation much, much more important? Because you want to bring them up to the point of qualifying. Number two, how do you see that working? Because that may initially be the most important part of this bill. And number three, how do you deal with the fact that if you're not giving trade preferences, you lose your leverage to increase implementation of labor rights, right? The whole point is you want to confer benefits, develop an interest in sustaining the benefits, then use that leverage to implement labor rights. So that there's a little bit of a quandary there that I think we'd have to. But by the way, the bill is a great bill, I think.
Let me just take one other question, then we'll have the panelists respond to everything that's out there.
I really appreciated the fact that you talked about enforcement, because that was one of my questions this morning. But the sense of the whole discussion from this morning and now is top-down, and I was an employer in Africa for 4 years. I worked with teachers for 8, but I was the education secretary. The issue that I found was that we had very good conditions of service that the government had put together in 1965, but the teachers didn't trust it. So there was a whole information, not just capacity building, but information that they needed to know their rights. And then there was the quantum leap to know their rights and then appeal to their rights. And that was the real stickler. And I'm not sure whether it fits for teachers or for government workers. My suspicion is we can have wonderful legislation and wonderful top-down concerns for workers' rights, but if the workers on the ground either are not aware of them or don't have the ability to appeal, but for once a year, that's for me a real question.
Let's start with the last one.
Sure. Yeah, I can. And that's a fantastic question. And actually, I cut my presentation sort of short so we could have a discussion. But one of the explicit goals of the capacity building is to increase worker awareness of their labor rights on the ground. So part of the idea is that the monies that are going to be distributed under this bill, at least a portion of them will be to rights education type programs. And there's also supposed to be a component to inform those groups on the ground of the petition, the possibility of the petition process. So that's a key component. You're absolutely right. With regards to the problem, kind of the chicken and the egg problem of losing leverage on workers' rights if you're not actually giving the benefits, I mean, I think one way to look at it is that the mere existence of the bill is a form of leverage because these countries presumably are going to be wanting to get to qualify for the bill in the first place. So that mere process of improving workers' rights in order to, you know, gain initial eligibility status hopefully will provide some of that leverage. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of how I see it a little bit. And lastly, I want to respond to the point about Human Rights Watch not taking a position on trade per se. You're absolutely right that there's a very close link between development and human rights. I completely agree. We're not a development organization, however, and I think largely in an effort to achieve some expertise in what we do, which is focused on, you know, rights specifically as opposed to the link between rights and development, we have simply made the institutional decision to not take a position on, you know, development or trade, but simply to look at how, you know, rights are protected in that context. But it's, you know, it's a very fine line and possibly an artificial line, but that's, you know, that's what we've had to do sort of in order to I guess maintain our expertise at what we do, which is look at basic human rights, including workers' rights.
And I'll answer Claude's question and tie it into what Mark said too. Part of the reason we don't know which countries will qualify for certain or not is because we've done such a horrendous job of investigating whether these countries are enforcing labor rights. And you know, the administration, and not just this one, but all of the past administrations, they've done a poor job of investigation. So we just don't know. Hopefully that'll get better, especially as we reform preferences. And Claude, you mentioned the point, you know, how do we help these countries? Importantly, the bill has eligibility criteria for the trade preferences. It doesn't have criteria for the trade capacity building. So the money that can go into helping the country and helping the workforce understand its rights and enforce those rights is available right away to get these countries up to speed. I think that the Cambodia experiment shows that when there is meaningful incentives out there that countries want, they will respond by enforcing labor rights. You mentioned, how do you provide that incentive if you're providing them something they don't already enjoy? With respect to AGOA, AGOA expires in 2015. If this were in place, I think there would be some concern from many of the Africans that they better increase their labor standards because AGOA is going away. And if they want preferences, they've got to utilize this regime that has stricter eligibility criteria. Also, this program, this preference scheme is better than AGOA because AGOA leaves out so many products. And AGOA is not permanent. There's always some uncertainty around whether countries are going to continue to receive their benefits. And with respect to the countries that aren't already conferred benefits, Bangladesh and Cambodia come to mind, and they so desperately need preferences because China and Vietnam, to a lesser extent, is taking so much of their business away, they need anything they can get to remain competitive. And so I believe that they would quickly conform with our requirements.
Very much. This is a very stimulating discussion. And we are running a little bit late, but there is a healthy period of time for discussion built in at the end of the next session. So we should be able to revisit some of these topics if all of your questions haven't quite had a chance to come out yet. Could I ask the next panel to please come up?